Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I am David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And today I'm speaking with Sonia Songha Lee about her recent book, Building a Latino Civil Rights Movement, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. Dr. Lee is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Washington University. Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I am David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And today I'm speaking with Sonia Songha Lee about her recent book, Building a Latino Civil Rights Movement, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. Dr. Lee is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Washington University in St. Louis, where her research and teaching focuses on the constructions of racial and ethnic identities, Puerto Rican and Black freedom movements, and immigration, labor, and urban history. Professor Lee has received fellowship and research support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Library of Congress, among other awards and accolades. Hello, Sonia, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I really appreciate you coming on today. I was wondering I was wondering if you could begin our conversation today by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Anything about who I am, how I came to academia?
Exactly, all of that. A little bit about your personal background. I believe you're raised in Sao Paulo, Brazil, right?
Yeah.
So a little bit about that, maybe, and then everything else.
Sure. I was born and raised in Sao Paulo, Brazil. I am Korean, so I identify myself primarily as Asian American. Mm-hmm. My immigrant experience, I would say, was not so typical in terms of Asian Americans, because I brought a lot of my upbringing from Brazil into the context here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so I came here at the age of 14. I was living in Los Angeles. And one of my first experiences as an immigrant in the U.S. Was actually the L.A. riots of 1992. So I had just started going to high school here, and my parents had just set up a business in downtown LA. It was the kids' wholesale clothing store. And yeah, one day I came back home from school and my parents were home in the afternoon. And I thought, you know, what are you guys doing here? And they said, well, come here, watch the TV, see what's going on. And I saw the burning and the chaos, and I immediately started questioning, like, you know, what is all of this? And especially in the context of so many debates about Korean-American mm-hmm. conflicts with African-Americans specifically, I began to question, why is race such a powerful idea in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. And definitely in Brazil, I was aware of race, but it operated in a very different way. So I immediately began to question the way that race operated here in this country. And then when I went to Berkeley as a college student, we were going through debates about affirmative action because we were about to get rid of it through Act 209. And, you know, at the time I was a pre-med student. I didn't know anything about this. And I would have remained as one of the many ignorant people on this topic, mm-hmm. except for the fact that I just happened to be taking a class on African-American history. top five Professor Leon Litwack, whom I credit for having converted me to history. So, yeah, Professor Leon Litwack said that, you know, if you wanted to, you could definitely skip class and attend his student sit-ins. But he said that if we wanted to, we could also attend his teaching. And so what he did during that session was he gave a very historical and intellectual justification for his political stance on affirmative action. And at the time, for me, this was one of the most intellectually satisfying moments in my college education, right? I knew that this whole debate mattered, but from the majority of my Asian American friends, I got this really dissatisfying answer about how we personally don't benefit from it, and therefore we're not going to support this. And I wanted to know a lot more, right? Even if it doesn't benefit us personally, why is this important for America as a whole?
Right.
And Professor Leon Litwack's explanation for his support for it, given the history of slavery and Jim Crow and all of that, made so much sense to me, right? So I think that's when I began to really fall in love with history. Back then I was still a pre-med. And it was really by chance that I decided to major in history instead of molecular and cell biology. Well, I ended up doing both. But in terms of my career path, it just so happened that in my junior year in college, I started having a lot of back pain. And that basically meant that I knew medical school was, you know, out of my options. And, you know, the easy path for me was supposed to be teaching history in high school. Except for the fact that, yeah, by the end of my senior year, my back pain went away. And then by that point, I had become, you know, completely converted to history. And the crazy idea of applying to a PhD program came to me. And to my surprise, I actually got admitted to most of the schools I applied to. It was really shocking to me. I didn't expect that at all. There was really no one around me who wasn't academic. I had no model. I had nobody to even talk to about this. I just, this idea was just planted in my head through a TA, and I just sort of ran with it. And when I met with Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham at Harvard University, she became my advisor eventually. I just knew that this was going to be a good case for me, right? So, yeah, lo and behold, I started my graduate school training at Harvard, and that's how I started studying African-American history.
So I got a question. What did your parents think about you switching from, you know, being pre-med and becoming a doctor to, you know, becoming an academic and a historian?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were immigrants who didn't know anything, really. So, I mean, I was lucky in that I am the third daughter in a family of three, and my two older sisters did the very loyal thing to pursue very stable career paths. So my older sister is a lawyer, and my second sister is an orthodontist.
Gotcha.
And so with the third one, my parents were, you know, a lot more hands-off. And I was the one who just had this, you know, wild dream about studying African-American history. And, you know, my parents didn't know much about the topic. They just knew that I was studying something about Black history, right? And, yeah, around me, like I said, I had no models of how to pursue this, especially as an Asian-American studying Black history and later on Puerto Rican history. But I was able to do it mostly because I had, you know, a tremendous support network at Harvard amongst my grad school friends, and also amongst the many Puerto Rican scholars and Black scholars who had pioneered the field and who just welcomed me into the whole field. But yeah, there were a lot of moments of doubt because I really didn't know how feasible this was as a career path, and given all the politics that's embedded in any study that deals with race, there were a lot of moments of anxiety. Yeah, I have to be honest about that. But I also have to say I was really lucky to meet some really generous people who assured me that the questions that I was asking were really important, and that amazingly, people had not asked this question before, at least in a historical way. And that I was lucky to be at Harvard. I had the time and the resources to conduct my research and to write my dissertation. And, you know, I was able to eventually publish it in a book. So I found myself very fortunate in the fact that I took a fairly risky path, but things turned out really well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the support that I got from the academic community was huge. And it convinced me, even though things were very uncertain, it convinced me that it was worth it, right?
That's great. Yes, definitely. And that kind of brings me to the next question I had, which, you know, you got your start in history, at least through African-American studies and Black history. So how did this particular project develop? Because it's not just a Black history. It's a multiracial history that includes, of course, Puerto Ricans and African-Americans kind of working together. So how did you come about, you know, developing this topic? And, you know, you mentioned the question that was kind of driving in the back of your head. What was that question that drove you to develop this book project?
Yeah, so the whole project is, in a very indirect way, a very autobiographical question, right? So as an immigrant, like I said, as a Korean-American who experienced the LA riots, first thing as I came here to this country, I was extremely invested in answering the question, what is the relationship between African-Americans and other people of color, or immigrants,
mm-hmm.
right? And actually, for one of my first research papers that I wrote at Harvard, I analyzed the relationship between African-Americans and Japanese-Americans in California mm-hmm. during World War II.
Right.
And that was a fun project, but I knew at the end of it that that was not necessarily what I wanted to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And the semester after I wrote that paper, I just happened to read Altagracia Ortiz's article on the International Ladies Garment Workers Union.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just, you know, a random article that I read for a class where she documents the fact that the Black members of the union and the Puerto Rican members of the union took very different stances when Herbert Hill from the NAACP charged the union of being racially discriminatory against both Black and Puerto Rican members.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she raises a number of possibilities as to why the Black and Puerto Rican members took such different stances. And that just raised a number of questions for me about the particularities of their experiences. And when I decided to write about this, my dissertation, I certainly knew nothing about this whole history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was a complete outsider. I mean, people later on asked me, why did you write about this? Are you from New York City? You're clearly not Black or Puerto Rican, right? And I was like, yeah, I was a complete outsider. I knew nothing. One of my friends, who's Blumby, she said, because I asked her, because she was from New York, and I said, what do Puerto Ricans look like? And she said, they look like me. Everybody thought that I was Puerto Rican. I mean, I had no clue. You know, Andy Torres was actually one of the first professors that I approached. He was at UMass Boston at the time. And he asked me point blank, Sonia, why do you want to write about us? Are you interested in Puerto Ricans, right? And I said, look, I read that article by Altagracia Ortiz, and it was really interesting. And as an immigrant, I have a lot of questions about African Americans' relationships with other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he was one of those key people who just totally welcomed me into this field, into the scholarship. He told me that, yes, I was going to find materials within the labor records, but also that I should really look into the community control movement because
mm-hmm.
I was going to find a lot more answers
right.
to the kinds of questions that I was asking in that social movement, and he was absolutely right. You know, soon after, and that was Miriam Jimenez-Roman at the Schomburg, and then the late Juan Flores. When I went to Centro for the first time, Jorge Matos, who was named librarian there, was extremely generous with the time that he spent, you know, recommending a bunch of books. And yeah, so I just kind of, you know, delved into the whole literature. William Jimenez was a filmmaker who gave me my first contacts, the people who I ended up interviewing. right? Wow. And Manny Diaz was one of my first interviewees. And, you know, his whole life story definitely indicated to me that I was on the right path, right? So this is 2003. And what I want to highlight here is that I was really lucky because, yeah, this question might have seemed irrelevant or unimportant to some people when I first started thinking about it. But 2003 was the first year when the U.S. Census came out with the fact that Latinos surpassed African-Americans as the largest minority group in the U.S., right?
Right.
And that started raising all kinds of questions about how we should address racial justice in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, Latinos mattered, right?
Right, right.
And even though the mainstream media was painting a very negative picture of, you know, constant conflict and competition for your jobs between the two groups, and et cetera, I knew that that story was, you know, only part of the truth, definitely not the entire truth. And Manny Diaz was just a clear picture of how there was a lot more overlap in that history, right?
Right.
He himself identified as Puerto Rican and as a person of African descent. So I realized that there was a lot to look into in this whole history. And I just started running with it, with all the archival research and interviewing and all of that.
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing it up, because that is a key component of this book and of any works that really seek to, add something to a narrative that is so established, like the civil rights movement, right? And what I'm referring to here is your use of oral history. And so for those of us that, study now, it's, more like the post-war era, this have been, and in the past, for a number of historians, to kind of revise history in that way, to show this other perspective, oral history has been critical. And that's certainly a key part of your book. And I know that's another research and teaching interest that you have. So in regards to the book, the book itself focuses on this, on the political context, right, in which Puerto Ricans and African Americans begin to engage in a shared struggle over racism, poverty, and marginalization in New York City. And your initial chapters begin by discussing the failures of post-war growth liberalism, in which blacks and Puerto Ricans were not provided with equal opportunities to really partake of the affluent society of the 1950s and early 1960s. And so looking around at their communities, and some of these communities like East Harlem and South Bronx that you discuss in the book, which had been stripped of municipal services and private investment, this was all manifested by urban decay, crowded substandard housing, and segregated underfunded schools. In that context, blacks and Puerto Ricans begin to develop, as you explain in the first chapter, a common anti-racist sensibility that recognize their shared experience and marginalized subject positions within New York City. So the middle chapters, which is really want to focus our conversation, begin to narrate the issues, the people, the strategies, and mobilizations that united blacks and Puerto Ricans in this shared struggle to take control over their communities. Chapter 3 in particular provides the key moment, I think, of transition in the story, when African Americans and Puerto Ricans really begin to work and strategize together on anti-delinquency programs and the issue of school integration. And here, the settlement houses and other social reform organizations provided a key space for the cultivation of what you start to explain as a more Puerto Rican identity that's less connected to the Hispanic identity that had been pretty much articulated earlier. So can you talk a bit about that, how, the role of the settlement houses and these other social reform organizations, how they provide this space for this cultivation of both Puerto Rican identity and then facilitate Puerto Ricans as a politicized minority that begin to work with African Americans?
Sure. What I try to address in Chapter 3 is this question of how Puerto Ricans dealt with the question of whether they would identify themselves politically as an ethnic group or as a racial group, right? And this is a very important question from the very early stages of the Puerto Rican migration to the mainland, because they were aware of the fact that many people mistook them as black, and very few Americans knew about the history of Puerto Rico and its relationship with the U.S. government. And for a long time, the majority of Puerto Rican leaders had really equivocated on the question of race, because they knew that it might stigmatize them.
Right.
And so many of the Puerto Rican leaders, I argue, adopted an ethnic identity up until the 1950s, right? Mm-hmm. And claiming a Hispanic identity was a part of that, right? To compare themselves to European immigrants much more than African-Americans in order to have the benefit of being assumed to be immigrants who are going to succeed, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so there was a definite investment in that. And the way in which settlement houses provided a space where Puerto Ricans could work all of this out was that settlement houses were institutions that focused on local empowerment and local organizing. Right. They, and I know that the whole history of settlement houses would not suggest that when it comes to communities of color, right? It's very much focused on European immigrants,
right.
Empowerment a lot more than African-American migrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in New York City in the 1950s, mostly because of World War II and the Cold War, there was a shift in priorities amongst the white leadership because they recognized that racial democracy became so crucial to our national identity as Americans,
right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So despite their ignorance about all of the issues that African-American and Puerto Rican migrants faced, they did provide a space for Puerto Rican migrants and African-Americans to come together and to work together to solve local problems, right? So this was an example that came through in the Union Settlement. And in the process, it became obvious that what Puerto Ricans and African-Americans had in common was this experience as racialized minorities, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Puerto Ricans were given especially this sort of ambiguous space where they could identify with African Americans, but they didn't have to immediately claim a racial identity, right? They could try to figure out what would be the benefits, the disadvantages of either option. And I found that really the school boycott of 1964 was this pivotal moment.
Mm-hmm.
When Puerto Rican leaders decided that after this whole history of equivocating on this topic, that it would really be more beneficial for them to publicly recognize their position as racialized minorities rather mm-hmm. than try to pretend that they could become white, right?
Right, right.
And it was really the experience of the 1950s that convinced them that this was going to be their path, right? They tried and they believed that by learning English and that by working hard, that they would eventually reach economic stability and that they would be allowed into the white neighborhoods and gain all the privileges of the former European immigrants. But that just didn't happen, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so as the Black freedom movement is emerging all over the country, a lot of the Puerto Rican parents decide that, yes, it's actually going to be best for us to join the Black parents in this movement. Right? And it's a move that I think comes through in the school boycott just because there is such a huge number of Puerto Rican parents who don't send their kids to school that day,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Making a very public stance on their position on this whole issue. And yet, at the same time, there was a lot of fear about the repercussions of such an action. And so I try to argue that there were certain leaders who were very comfortable aligning themselves with African-American activists, right? Manny Diaz and Hidden Valentin were definitely one of them. And there were many who saw benefits attached to identifying themselves as with African-Americans at this time, but who were still very fearful, okay, of what it might mean if Puerto Ricans were now known also as a minority group.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I talk a lot about individuals like Joseph Monserrat, who was one of the most articulate Puerto Rican leaders who tried to create a Puerto Rican ethnic identity, even as he aligned himself with Black leaders,
right? Mm-hmm.
He couldn't maintain this for very long because it's an oxymoron, right? To completely distinguish Puerto Ricans as an ethnic group and not a racial group continuously, even as they aligned themselves with the Black leaders. But he really tried to do this as long as possible. And he gives all kinds of, you know, really crazy interpretations of Puerto Rican, the history of Puerto Rican slavery as he's trying to do this, trying to emphasize that even though Puerto Ricans had a history of slavery, somehow they were not damaged by it as much as African Americans were. Mm-hmm. And so I make the argument that this was very much of a contested identity,
right?
It was not obvious exactly what it would mean for Puerto Ricans to identify as minorities. I mean, could they identify as minorities but still distinguish themselves from African Americans in some way?
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is a tough question for many of the leaders, and they tried to fight it out for as long as they could.
Right, and it speaks, I think, to the issue of ethnic communities that are engaged in social struggle and trying to plan and strategize, right, how to improve their situation, and that there's a group here of activists and leaders in the community that kind of have to take charge of the situation to build a strategy that supposedly speaks for the collective group, but at the same time, there's a lot of discussion and differing of opinion in the Puerto Rican community, as with any other community, ethnic community, right, as to how people identify and what their experience is and what the important issues are, right? And you cover quite a bit of that in the chapter, not just this chapter, but a number of the chapters, and that's something that I appreciated, because the issue of, contesting identity as it's being built, from within the group, and also, in addition to pressures from, the outside, other external groups, how they view you, how society, the group feels they're being treated by society, right? How are they marginalized? All those things, get mixed together in the strategies that these activists are beginning to make at this time, right? And so ethnic identity, as you point out, begins to be, it's a strategic decision, right, in their struggle, mm-hmm. and in the mobilizations that begin to take place. Is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about you? You spoke about the school boycott as an important galvanizing type of mobilization. Also, will you speak a little bit about the March on Washington? I believe from the reading in your book, you mentioned there's a few thousand, right, Puerto Ricans that actually participated in the March on Washington, right? So can you speak about that and how that was also an important moment and mobilization that helped to push the ethnic identity and strategy towards, identifying as more Puerto Rican and as a, racialized minority?
Sure. So what happened with the March on Washington is that a lot of the Puerto Ricans who decide to participate in the march come from specific neighborhoods in New York City, right? So one of them is the Lower East Side. Just because Mobilization for Youth, called an MFY, had been around since the early 1960s, and they had been set up as a sort of experiment to the later anti-poverty programs, right? And within the MFY structure, it was really unclear how the program was going to deal with its so-called clients for social services, right? And also engage in political activism and fighting together as a mixture of both academics, activists, certain health leaders, etc. And so they all had different visions about what it was supposed to be. And initially, it was simply a social services agency, right? So a lot of the Black and Puerto Rican youth who use their services were youth who were simply looking for jobs, some kind of treatment for drug addiction, perhaps parents who are looking into a diet for schooling or tenant groups, but they really didn't have any sort of cohesion as a group. And what happened in 1963 is that a number of the Puerto Rican parents who were associated with MFY attended March in Washington, and what became evident, at least to the archives that I found within MFY, is that this was a transformative experience for them. Okay, so they attended this national meeting, and they saw that there were thousands and thousands of Americans who supported the Black Freedom Movement, and as a result, they recognized that there was tremendous power attached to this movement,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they began to see that even though this whole time they had feared associating themselves with African American parents, that really this was actually a politically beneficial move. You begin to see Puerto Rican parents organizing with Black parents and actually challenging school principals,
right.
who had not been responding to their requests about what was happening to their kids' education. You see the emergence of several tenant groups, and this is all within the emergence of the Black student movement. Right? Mm-hmm. So you have core activists, Congress of Racial Equality activists, who were already trying to organize tenant groups, and when the Puerto Rican parents decide to join the movement, they become a critical constituency in that effort. So I think, again, it was one of those pivotal moments because it highlighted the power that was attached to the National Black Freedom Movement, something mm-hmm. that was not very obvious in the local level, but they were able to see that once they stepped outside.
Right. And the other point you make very clearly in the chapter is the issue of the importance of the settlement houses and other early type of a social reform organization participation by Puerto Ricans was that these type of groups really fostered the growth of indigenous leadership. And you insinuated that at first. You mentioned that when you're talking about how in New York City, the settlement houses started to really have that or embrace the philosophy of assisting communities in developing their own form of communal control. But that issue of fostering indigenous grassroots leadership was really important, right, to this initial stage in the movement. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the settlement houses form kind of the early stage of this collaboration and serve as a precursor for the coalitional work that would develop in war and poverty programs as those came about. So can you talk a bit about that now at this point, particularly how Puerto Rican and African-American cross-racial organization continued to evolve through Great Society initiatives like the War on Poverty?
Sure. So the War on Poverty provided a crucial space for Puerto Rican activists to come together with Black activists because, at least theoretically, it was a racially neutral program.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask insiders within Washington, they would all tell you that it was a program developed as a response to the civil rights movement, right? But they knew that they couldn't pitch it in that way because they would receive too much opposition from the Southern Democrats. And so because it was theoretically racially neutral, Puerto Rican activists realized that they could also benefit from it. And so a lot of scholars have emphasized that the War on Poverty created this extremely competitive environment where, Black and Puerto Rican groups or Mexican-American groups were constantly just vying for money, and it created more racial division than before, et cetera.
Right.
And I think that's part of the story, and it's definitely true in New York City in the late 1960s. But the argument that I make is that, at least initially, within the 1964-66 time period, there was a lot more that to face than simply the competition for anti-poverty funds, right? So for example, when I talk about the emergence of the first Puerto Rican leadership that decided to enlist Puerto Ricans into this federal program, I talk about the fact that they weren't sure whether it would be okay to identify themselves as poor people, right? And so Manny Diaz was one of the leaders who tried to go around New York City getting people to join some of these anti-poverty groups. And he said that some of the people would say things like, what do you mean, an anti-poverty organization? I'm not poor. I'm not black.
Right.
Black people are the poor people. I'm not black. I'm not poor. And this was extremely ironic because Puerto Ricans were actually poorer than African-Americans as a group. But what he found there was this very active resistance against this public association between Puerto Ricans and African Americans as poor people, right? And so ultimately, when the Puerto Rican leadership decided that this was worthwhile, it was not just because they wanted money. I mean, yes, money was important. They needed funding to organize themselves and to improve the housing conditions and et cetera. But it was a political decision made based on the benefits associated with recognizing their true status as indeed the poorest New Yorkers, right? Julio Morales also talks about the fact that, again, initially a lot of leaders didn't want to so-called air their dirty laundry, right?
Right.
They didn't want to be seen as a special group that needed extra help from the government, right? Because that was assumed to be too stigmatizing But again, Julio Morales was one of those leaders who recognized that it didn't have to be stigmatizing, because with the funding, they could actually organize themselves and gain all the benefits of citizenship that they deserved. Mm-hmm. So the argument that I make is that in the process of organizing, of thinking strategically about how they should make their case to the federal government and to the local politicians, that Puerto Rican leaders were transformed, right? That mm-hmm. it wasn't just about money, but it was really about creating a certain identity where they recognized their situation and tried to formulate in such a way that they could empower themselves in the process.
Right. And you just mentioned, I think in passing, the issue of Puerto Rican citizenship, which I've always found interesting, and it really is unique in the Latino experience case. And most of the listeners in this channel will realize this, but for those that don't, that, you know, Puerto Ricans are the immigrant group, the one that arrived, so to speak, you know, with citizenship in already established, right? And so that's really part mm-hmm. of their unique struggle in that, they have the perception, at least, you know, this is popular society, had the perception that Puerto Ricans were foreigners because they were one of these more recent immigrant groups, particularly became more visible in, you know, in the post-war era, although they had been migrating, you know, to the United States since, you know, the late 19th century, right, for other reasons. But that Puerto Ricans actually had citizenship. And so my question is, to what extent do you think, and I'm not sure if your research spoke to this much, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. To what extent would you think that the issue or the fact that Puerto Ricans had citizenship, how did that play in their kind of coming to this realization that they were indeed racialized minorities and that, you know, thereby creating the strategy of working within these war and poverty programs and initiatives was to their benefit?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Sure. I just want to preface this by saying that Lauren Thomas is actually
right.
somebody who looked at this question a lot more closely,
mm-hmm.
The question of Puerto Rican citizenship. But I would say that within the post-war history of Puerto Ricans, even though technically they are not immigrants, they are migrants, right, because
right.
they are already U.S. citizens when they come here, many New Yorkers thought of them as immigrants, and many of them thought of themselves as immigrants because even though Puerto Rican migration had started in the early 20th century, soon after U.S. invaded Puerto Rico, we don't really see this huge surge of migration until Operation Bootstrap in the
right.
1940s, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so the majority of the Puerto Rican migrants still think of themselves as a group of recent migrants.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do adopt this identity of being new to this scene, still learning how to just make ends meet and understand the political process. And, you know, very similarly to the Mexican-American experience, many Puerto Rican migrants were assumed to be so-called culturally submissive.
Mm-hmm.
And this came up a lot in discussions amongst Black activists who were disappointed by the fact that a lot of Puerto Rican parents didn't want to get involved with school busing programs or any sort of organizing that was being led by Black parents. And even though it wasn't because of any sort of basic cultural difference, it was a set of different political priorities at the time, right? Many people still explain this as a sign of cultural submissiveness. And even Puerto Ricans themselves use this language to describe why they chose not to get politically involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I think their experience is actually very similar to that of Mexican-American
right.
immigrants. But it is true that by the time they begin to get mobilized and organized and they begin to see the similarity of their experiences with African-American citizens, they do claim their citizenship, right, as one more reason why they should have access to all of these things.
Right.
I mean, by this time, they had been working in the garment factories for decades, and they had tried to fight for housing for decades, and they did not find it possible to find quality housing. And so even though it was a very brief experience, their sense of being invested in this local place, right, becomes more solidified.
Right.
So it becomes one more tool. But besides the fact that they are hard workers and that they're decent parents, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And eventually, you know, it does become a reason why so many Puerto Rican leaders see themselves as being privileged Latinos compared to other Latino groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because their political mobilization doesn't have to be threatening mm-hmm. to the most vulnerable activists, right? Deportation is never something they have to fear. So, yeah, it's a privilege that they carry. But in terms of the exact difference that is made in the lived experiences of Puerto Ricans, I would say
exactly.
Those actually very similar.
Right, exactly.
Of, immigrants, yeah.
Right, right. And so, as you mentioned, it becomes kind of this more of a strategic realization as another, a tool or weapon in the quiver that is of citizenship and be able to make claims based on citizenship. Although this is a key moment when that starts to, you know, evolve from that, as we'll talk a bit more. But that, that migration experience, despite the fact that they so-called had citizenship in hand, really was, it became more of a process, right, as to understanding or I think strategically deciding how to use that, right? How to use mm-hmm. and use the issue that Puerto Rican migrants did have citizenship, and then use that to make claims on full membership in society, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah. And you're right. You referenced Lauren Thomas's wonderful work, and that's right. He speaks a lot more to this issue. So moving forward, I was wondering if you make the point in this chapter two, really, it starts to get made very clearly here that this is the point at which this is, I'm speaking to the war on poverty programs, that Black and Puerto Rican nationalism develop as two intertwined and mutually dependent political movements, right? And I would like you to talk a bit more about that, because perhaps maybe to some, it may sound a little, confusing at first, because one would just think of, what about the, longer so-called history of, and it's not so-called, but the longer history of African-American, social justice and civil rights struggles. But what led you to, make this assertion? This is indeed an assertion and an argument that you're making, right, that these forms of nationalism are developing together. They are indeed intertwined and mutually dependent.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I have to admit, it's a difficult question, because most of us have learned about the Black Power movement or the Chicano movement through the lens of leaders who emphasized cultural nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. The importance of emphasizing cultural differences from white Americans. And so even though we are led to believe that the whole movement led to increasing separation mm-hmm. amongst different groups, I think it's very clear in the New York story that the groups that emerged out of the Black Power movement in New York and the Puerto Rican liberation movement were really not working separately. They were working together,
right?
It wasn't just about a rhetoric of third world or, racialized minorities or et cetera. They were actually working together in joint projects. And again, when it comes to this question, most people just think about the Young Lords Party.
Mm-hmm.
As the one group of Puerto Ricans who recognize this reality and the importance of aligning themselves with the Black Panther Party. And,
right.
Johanna Fernandez is doing great work in documenting that amazing history. But what I wanted to highlight was that it wasn't just the Young Lords Party, right?
But right.
There were a bunch of other youth groups who were doing similar things, and that even before the Young Lords Party came together, at least 2 decades before, a decade and a half before they started doing what they did, there was this earlier generation of, sure, more reformist type of leaders, but Puerto Rican leaders who were also creating similar ideas, right? So the best places where I found this sort of thing happening was within the community control movement.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I tried to revisit the whole Ocean Hill-Brownsville conflict.
Right.
This is a very well-known story, and it's one of the most famous stories when it comes to what Black Power looked like in the North. Right?
And this is the basis of Chapter 5, right?
Right. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. And that whole story depicts Black Power leaders in New York as this beleaguered minority that increased racial polarization between Blacks and whites. And even though the scholarship legitimizes their actions, right, and portrays them as intellectuals and activists with, you know, reasonable demands, the whole story is sort of negative. Ocean Hill Brownsville tells a story we almost have to mourn about, okay? And what I found in the history of Black and Puerto Rican parents organizing was that there were actually a lot of great things that emerged out of this movement, right? So, for example, Ocean Hill Brownsville District was the first district that actually implemented the first bilingual education program in the East Coast in 1968. PS-155 came out of the Ocean Hill Brownsville Demonstration District. It was led by Black leaders, but this group of Black leaders very much supported Puerto Rican parents organizing within this experimental district. And Puerto Rican parents definitely borrowed from Black parents' emphasis on Black history and the importance of having Black teachers.
Exactly.
To emphasize the importance of having bilingual education being conducted by Puerto Rican teachers, right? And the whole process of affirming their language was supposed to create this complete psychological transformation for Puerto Rican students who had been neglected in the school system for years. And Luis Fuentes was one of those guys who was invited from Georgia. He had been living in Georgia for a long time, and when he was invited to lead this program at PS 155, he was actually really skeptical about bilingual education. He didn't believe in it. Because, again, the majority of Puerto Rican teachers had adopted this assimilationist view of how they were going to access quality education. But in the process, he was convinced by the Puerto Rican parents that this was going to make a difference. And he saw in the classrooms that it really did make a difference, right? So Spanish was taught alongside Swahili, and Puerto Rican students began to appreciate their culture just as Black students began to appreciate African history, African languages. And so the whole thing really was this joint movement where even though they had separate programs, they were mutually invested, I say, in the concept of cultural pluralism.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That Black Power was about promoting cultural pluralism, appreciating cultural differences, and maintaining it. And the same thing happens with East Harlem. Okay, so another example where I see Black Power really fostering the empowerment of Puerto Rican parents and students is in District 4. So this was the first Puerto Rican-led district. We saw the emergence of the first Puerto Rican district superintendent in District 4 in East Harlem. Anthony Alvarado did a tremendous job administering the whole system in the 1970s. And the whole thing was so successful that District 4 was called the Miracle in East Harlem, right? Because it was one of the few neighborhoods made up of students of color who that saw a dramatic increase in academic performance at a time when many other districts were not showing similar impacts. And so this district really comes out of the community control movement,
right,
which again was led by Black parents, right? So IS 201, which is the beginning of the story when it comes to the history of District 4, Black parents were the majority of IS 201 as a demonstration district. And again, when I interviewed Babette Edwards and Hannah Blockington, these were two Black parents who were heavily involved with IS 201, they said that, yes, they did encounter difficulties when it came to organizing Puerto Rican parents, but this was not some kind of insurmountable cultural gap, right?
Right.
They said that as soon as they got Puerto Rican school aides to act as translators between them and other Puerto Rican parents, that, you know, it was very easy to organize them and to get them to also create their own PTAs and join them in their fight to challenge the white school principals about what their kids were getting in schools. And so, you know, Hernan Lafontaine, he becomes one of the administrators at IS-201, and later on he becomes the main principal of PS-25. And PS-25 was the first bilingual school in right. New York City, right in the South Bronx. So then, you know, the emergence of all these programs that we now associate with Latino civil rights
exactly,
were
right.
born out of the Black Power movement.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so I really do want to emphasize that you can't view these movements as separate from each other because they were intimately connected. And we really have to give credit to Black Power leaders for creating this really revolutionary concept that cultural pluralism was not this crazy idea, but that it was an idea that we could implement in the U.S. within mainstream institutions of education.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's a very key, critical point that is made in your work, and I appreciate it that that ethnic nationalism in of itself wasn't as separatist as it's been portrayed both in media and maybe even in earlier studies, academic studies, you know, that it really did foster approaches to achieve cultural pluralism. Your example of bilingual education is an ideal one. And I myself, when I was reading, you know, chapter 5 and where you're making that point, was kind of shocked and surprised, even, you know, stunned a little bit that it was a program and initiative that was supported by, you know, both, not of course, not only Puerto Ricans, but by, you know, Black Power and African American activists, you know, in the area. So, I definitely think that has an important, historical lessons. And I think that's where, you know, as we're running short on time, I'd like to get you to, comment, you know, at this point, maybe on some thoughts. So chapter 6 kind of covers the point that you make in the book is that this was a kind of short window, you know, really the mid 1960s, or you say 64 to 66, where this kind of a really neat flowering of the interdependence and development of both Black Power and Puerto Rican nationalism in communities like East Harlem and South Bronx. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that. What's the significance of this movement, you know, at this moment in time, in, you know, ethnic politics and civic engagement?
Great question. Yeah, I think that this history is extremely relevant when it comes to debates about what is the significance of Latinos in the U.S. Right? We keep on talking about the Latino vote. What difference is it going to make in presidential elections and other kinds of political shifts in America? And what I want to emphasize here is that we can choose whether we portray Latinos as a group of people who are essentially different from African Americans, who have a completely different set of issues, or we can portray them as individuals who had very much shared experiences. Right, so police brutality is one of those key issues where I still see an investment amongst very progressive Latino leaders, but who nevertheless create this depiction of police brutality being looking a certain way within Black communities and a completely different way within Latino communities. Right, so if you look at the long history of police brutality, you know that both Blacks and Latinos have been victims of police brutality. But today, when we talk about this, we just focus on the undocumented immigrants and the violence that they experience in detention centers. But they only make up 15% of the Latino population. So what about the rest of the 85? Right? Mm-hmm. Why are we hesitant to talk about their experiences? Right? So again, I think we have to understand that even though it might be important to create a very distinct Latino political base and an agenda, that we still have to recognize the shared experiences. Right? Because these folks have mutual investments in how our public policies need to change, right? So, yeah, when it comes to the whole history of what happened in New York City, what I tried to document in Chapter 6 is that there was this connection between growing class conflicts within the movement, right? And the emergence of Hispanicity as an identity that was incompatible with Blackness.
Right.
Right. And I'm just going to give you one example for the sake of time.
Please,
Antonia Pantoja was one of those amazing, amazing Puerto Rican leaders who definitely benefited from the mentorship that she had from Black activists. And I think, you know, in her autobiography, she even states that she realized that she was a Black woman, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, by the late 1960s, she is one of the many Puerto Rican leaders who somehow becomes convinced that creating a separate political base is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, she exaggerates differences between Puerto Rican activists and Black activists.
Right.
Right? She says that Black activists are too angry and the Puerto Rican activists are not going to adopt their angry stance. And, you know, Puerto Ricans are, by culture, more patient. And, I mean, this was such a reductionistic way to talk about politics.
Right.
And yet, there is this investment at this time to construct Puerto Ricanness as something that was very different from Blackness, mm-hmm. right? And I try to at least validate some of their experiences and the reasons why they thought that this was politically strategic.
Mm-hmm.
But I also try to document how this was a move that really created more, it erased the histories a lot more than it revealed it, right?
Right.
And so I think this is an issue that we have to think very thoughtfully about today. When we talk about the importance of the Latino vote,
right.
Are we thinking about Latinos as only an immigrant group that speaks Spanish and that is racially mixed?
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or are we also recognizing that there are many Afro-Latinos whose experiences are very similar to that of African-Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? And that they have very similar concerns when it comes to issues about quality education and quality housing and police brutality and et cetera. These issues are not that different. So I think we'll have to revisit these questions through a historical lens.
Certainly, and it's one of the topics that is, you know, the formation of ethnic identity in connection to, political activism that just fascinates me. It is, you know, reductionist to say that, ethnic identity is always formed through political activism. It certainly isn't. But there's certainly a strong connection between ethnic identity formation and political mobilizations. And I think particularly throughout, I guess you could push it, further back, but I think particularly in the 20th century, the post-war era, as you see, this is a key moment of it. You know, at one point embracing a type of Puerto Rican nationalism that's very close to and intertwined, as you say, with Black nationalism, to then later evolving as a political strategy and trying to distance, providing some type of distance between that former position and identity. And so it just, to me, it's fascinating. It speaks to just the complexities of how ethnic identities are formed and the conditions under which they shape they emerge, they develop, etc. And that many times it's situational and mm-hmm. politically advantageous even, which I think strikes some as maybe inauthentic, but that's just how identity works, is it not? There's certainly a deep amount of strategy that goes involved and, that's built out of situational context. So I think your book is just, wonderful at teasing out, again, one of these key moments where identities, particularly between Blacks and Latinos, African-Americans and Latinos, are shaped and evolve in ways that at least through popular discourse, would strike us as odd.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the question of other arenas where ethnic identities are being shaped, I'm not addressing those, and the mm-hmm. cultural arena is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? One could make the argument that Hispanicity was really born out of the world of Hispanic music and
right.
TV shows and et cetera. And yeah, that's definitely true. But there's also a lot of power that comes with the voices that are elevated because they are congressmen and councilmen and school chancellors and et cetera. Those mm-hmm. are the people that I pay attention to.
Exactly. And it's certainly the case, right, that people maintain simultaneous identities that are seemingly conflicting at the same time. So one could, in this moment, identify as Hispanic in one social arena, but then perhaps in the political arena, identifies as something different, right? And so anyways, it's I appreciate your comments on this and your time, taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me on this, on your book and on the channel. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, close us out by talking a bit about what it is you're currently working on.
Sure. My second project focuses on the history of drug addiction studies and the Black Puerto Rican and Chicano freedom movement. So this came out of my knowledge of Kenneth Clark as a very prominent Black psychologist in New York. But from that entry point, I realized that within the debate about heroin addiction, which was something that affected primarily Black, Puerto Rican, and Mexican-American youth in the late 1960s, right?
Right.
I began to see that there was this whole divide in the literature between historians who focus on mass incarceration as a recent phenomenon, right? And drug addiction studies. So basically, within prison history, we do recognize the fact that drug offense was a major reason why Blacks and Latinos were over-incarcerated since the 1970s and 80s, right? But I thought that there was really not a lot of attention paid to how drug addiction was understood at the time, like how it's understood today, and how Black and Latino drug addicts are sort of portrayed in popular context as well as political context. And then I thought that within drug addiction studies, there's a lot of emphasis on white scientists, well, public policy makers about mental maintenance and the benefits and the advantages of medicalizing drug addiction. And yet, the only time that Black power leaders emerge in this whole narrative is when they come out in opposition to medical maintenance, claiming that it was just a form of chemical slavery, right? And what I realized in the process of going through the archives is that there was actually a good number of Black and Latino psychiatrists and psychologists who didn't really maintain such a narrow view of the human mind and who actually integrated methadone maintenance with political organizing and psychotherapy. And so I've become really invested in trying to document their intellectual contribution, right, not only as political activists, but also as scientists. Again, so many of these Black and Latino psychiatrists, psychologists, were assumed to be simply political in their motivations, just because of their racial status. But I think that, you know, they had a lot of scientifically valid points that they made when it comes to drug addiction treatment, and that their thoughts really matter when we talk about mass incarceration and steps that we had to take towards decarceration, right? I think in a very simple way, I'm trying to understand why so many Americans believe that Blacks and Latinos are somehow more prone to drug addiction than whites.
Right.
And why somehow if it's harder to treat them than to treat white drug addicts. So yeah, there's a whole history attached to that, not only in terms of the politicians, but also in terms of the mental health professionals. So I'm trying to write about that.
Gotcha. Wow. Great. That sounds wonderful. Well, thanks again, Sonia, for your time. I really appreciate you coming on to New Books in Latino Studies. And I wish you the best of luck in developing and finishing that project.
Thank you, Jay. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here. Thanks again for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Sonia Song-Ha Lee, author of Building a Latino Civil Rights Movement, Puerto Ricans, African Americans, and the Pursuit of Racial Justice in New York City, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. We'd love to hear your feedback on today's conversation. You may reach us at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also tweet us or comment on our Facebook page. We also encourage you to get a copy of Dr. Lee's book, and you may do so by following the Amazon link on our New Books in Latino Studies page.